3. The Road to Obstruction. On March 1, 2017, nearly 6 weeks after President Trump had raised his right hand and swore to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States, he struggled to read aloud the words of the founding document. A film crew had come to the White House to record the new president reading a section of the Constitution. Trump chose to participate in the HBO production because he did not want to forego the chance to be filmed for history. And he knew that as the sitting president, he would be the documentary's most important character. The documentary, titled The Words That Built America, was directed by Alexandra Pelosi, a daughter of House Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi. Her conceit was that the country was starkly divided after the ugliness of the 2016 campaign, but the founding documents remained a unifying force for the nation's factions. Pelosi and her team had a novel and distinctly bipartisan hook. All six living presidents, as well as six vice presidents, would join in reading the Constitution on camera, while other political figures and actors would read portions of the Bill of Rights and the Declaration of Independence. Each performance would be edited to create a lively, unabridged reading of the treasured documents that have united the nation for more than two centuries. On March 1st, Pelosi and her crew arrived at the White House, and as they were getting ready in the Blue Room, Trump entered the opulent parlor, which sits at the center of the residence's first floor and opens onto the south portico. The Blue Room, distinguished by its French blue draperies and gold wallpaper, is steeped in history. It was where President Grover Cleveland and his wife exchanged wedding vows in 1886, and every December, the White House's primary Christmas tree is erected at the center of the oval-shaped room. On this day, Trump seemed stiff and uncomfortable. Though he was technically in his own home, he did not greet his guests. Rather, he stood, waiting for someone to approach him. Pelosi moved in to thank Trump for participating in this special history project, but he appeared to have no idea who she was, apparently not briefed on her political lineage or her role as the director. The president asked for some water, and with no staff bringing any to him, Pelosi handed him a bottle of Aquafina from her purse. "I've been into the White House," Pelosi later said of visits to see previous presidents. "There are always protocols. Here, there were no rules. No protocol." She added, "There's so much wrong with the whole thing. I'm thinking, isn't there someone who's supposed to guard what he's eating and drinking?" Meanwhile, a White House staffer gave the other crew members instructions about what they could and could not do with the president. The very first rule was for the makeup artist: do not touch the president's hair. On his face, light powder only. The next instruction was for the technical crew: could they make the lighting a little more orange? The president preferred a warm glow on camera. The mention of orange struck some in the room as an odd choice. Outside the bubble of the White House, late-night TV show hosts and cartoonists had been mocking the perpetually orange hue of Trump's skin. Pelosi had let presidents and vice presidents choose the portion of the Constitution they wanted to read. Many were wary of reading the section on the rules for impeachment or foreign emoluments. Trump had selected the opening of Article 2, the part of the Constitution that addresses a president's election and the scope of his or her power. It would normally have been the perfect selection for a president, but was an ironic one for Trump, who had spoken of his desire to exercise his executive power as much as possible, including by threatening Congress and challenging the judiciary. With LED lights on stilts in front of him, Trump took his seat. "You're lucky you got the easy part," Pelosi told him cheerfully. "It gets complicated after this." But the president stumbled, trying to get out the words in the arcane, stilted form the Founding Fathers had written. Trump grew irritated. "It's very hard to do because of the language here," Trump told the crew. "It's very hard to get through that whole thing without a stumble," he added. "It's like a different language, right?" The cameraman tried to calm Trump, telling him it was no big deal, to take a moment and start over. Trump tried again, but again remarked, "It's like a foreign language." The section, like many parts of the Constitution, was slightly awkward. An anachronistic arrangement of words that don't naturally trip off the tongue. Members of the crew exchanged looks, trying not to be obvious. Some believed Trump would eventually get it, but others were more concerned. The president, already bristling about his missteps, was getting angry. He chided the crew, accusing them of distracting him. "You know, your paper was making a lot of noise. It's tough enough," Trump said. "Every time he stumbled, he manufactured something to blame people," another person in the room recalled. "He never said, 'Sorry, I'm messing this up.' Other people would screw up and say, 'Oh, I'm sorry.' They would be self-effacing. He was making up excuses and saying there were distracting sounds. He was definitely blaming everyone for his inability to get through it. That was prickly. Or childish." Though stiff, he eventually made it through without any errors. Trump presented a stark contrast to many other readers, including the Supreme Court Associate Justice Stephen Breyer, who read as if he knew the full text by heart, and Senator Ted Cruz, who knew it from beginning to end as a result of performing dramatic readings of the Constitution as a high school student, according to Pelosi. "Donald Trump is a celebrity, and he came to perform," she said. "He had not practiced it beforehand. I don't think anyone would show up to read the Constitution without practicing it first." Whatever the reason for Trump's discomfort with the reading, several watching agreed on this much. He behaved like a brooding child, short-tempered, brittle, and quick to blame mystery distractions for the mistakes. "I didn't expect this, but I felt sorry for him," another witness said. When Vice President Pence is reading it, when former Vice President Dick Cheney is reading it, I knew they knew the Constitution, and I thought, before he got this job, he really should have read it. The next day, March 2nd, Attorney General Jeff Sessions, one of Trump's most steadfast allies, the man who served at the vanguard on immigration and other policies at the heart of the president's agenda, recused himself from oversight of the Russia investigation. During his January 10th confirmation hearing, in response to a question from the Democratic Senator Al Franken, Sessions had testified under oath that he did not have communications with the Russians during the 2016 campaign. He did not disclose that he had had two conversations during the campaign with Russian Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, a fact later revealed in a Washington Post story. The morning of March 2nd, the president got worked up at the prospect of Sessions bowing to escalating public pressure and recusing, believing the attorney general would look guilty for forgetting an inconsequential meeting and, most importantly, leave him unprotected and vulnerable. So the president called White House counsel Don McGahn to insist that he stop Sessions. "Sessions doesn't have to recuse," Trump bellowed, speaking so loudly that people in the West Wing hallway could make out what he was uttering from the Oval Office. "Whatever he said to Franken, so what?" Trump was incredulous. "Everyone is now saying he has to recuse," he repeated to McGahn. "He doesn't have to." McGahn was convinced that some of Trump's reasoning made sense, despite the angry tone he used to explain it. But other reasons were purely political. McGahn's mind raced through the risks, knowing the president's order had the potential not only to be a fool's errand, but also to get Trump into trouble for obstructing justice. McGahn had been loyal to Trump since the early days of the campaign. A veteran campaign lawyer, he was not the typical Trump supporter, yet he was one of the first to recognize the power of Trump's campaign and to join his team. In January 2015, he had watched the real estate developer and reality television star in action by flying with him to the Iowa Freedom Summit, hosted by Congressman Steve King. McGahn had calculated that due to a seismic shift in the GOP and the rising disaffection of rural white voters in both parties, a traditional Republican candidate like Mitt Romney or Jeb Bush could never win in 2016. The hulking billionaire that McGahn saw on stage in Iowa, home to the nation's first presidential caucuses, made a big impression and connected with the crowd in a way that surprised him. Trump took note that McGahn was in the green room, sizing up all the candidates, and figured he was an important player. When Trump later asked McGahn to be the lawyer for his campaign, McGahn said yes. Trump could tell that McGahn, a former member of the Federal Election Commission, knew his field and could see all the angles. Trump knew zip and was unapologetic about it. The candidate gave his lawyer broad autonomy and normally followed his advice. Once they were in the White House, however, their dynamic changed. Trump believed he was cornered early with a series of rules rigged to box him in and limit his power. It often fell to McGahn to deliver bad news. Cabinet secretaries and other aides pleaded for McGahn to come to the Oval Office to explain to Trump why he couldn't do this and couldn't do that. In one of the council's first discussions of executive power with the president, McGahn told Trump he couldn't automatically issue an executive order to impose tariffs on foreign countries' goods unless he had a grave reason. "I just want to do it. I'm the president. Can't I do it?" Trump asked him. "No," McGahn said, pointing out the standard role of Congress in imposing duties and tariffs on imports. "You need a study under the statute. There's a process. They have to do reports, and there has to be public notice." To Trump, McGahn became Dr. No. The White House counsel labored to keep bad ideas from germinating. McGahn, who carried a pocket constitution, saw it as his duty to protect Trump from the novices in his administration, who knew less about governing than a newly elected congressman coming out of a 2-week orientation session. McGahn had also rankled Ivanka Trump by riding herd on the ethical questions of the first daughter joining the West Wing staff. On March 2nd, McGahn called Sessions to tell him that Trump was not happy about the idea of his removing himself from the Russia investigation. Sessions responded that his hands were tied and that he intended to abide by the Justice Department's rules of recusal and follow the advice of the career ethics staff who were evaluating the situation. Other White House advisors also pressed Sessions and his deputies against recusing. Still, Trump went public with his feelings. Asked by reporters whether Sessions should recuse, Trump said, "I don't think so." The president said he had total confidence in Sessions. It was too late. Sessions hastily called a news conference and announced that he would not oversee any existing or future investigations that pertain to the Trump campaign. Sessions was following the rules, which plainly stated that no Justice Department official could participate in a criminal investigation if he or she has a personal or political relationship with an individual or organization substantially involved in the investigation. When a reporter asked Sessions about Trump's and White House Press Secretary Sean Spicer's comments that the Attorney General didn't need to recuse, the Attorney General smiled awkwardly and shrugged. "They don't know the rules, the ethics rules," he said. "Most people don't." Trump watched Sessions' news conference from aboard Air Force One, returning from a short afternoon trip to Newport News, Virginia, to visit the USS Gerald R. Ford, the Navy's newest nuclear-powered warship. He was furious. As the diminutive Alabaman spoke from his lectern at the Justice Department, all the president saw was weakness and disloyalty. He railed about how weak and horrible the attorney general was. He said he should never have picked him for the job. To Trump, this was the end of Sessions. His attorney general had betrayed him. But this was also the moment Trump started to turn on McGahn, one of his earliest backers, for failing to stop the recusal. He began shutting out the very lawyer who had been working thanklessly to protect him from his own dangerous impulses. "He should have told me he was going to do this," Trump fumed about Sessions. "If he couldn't handle this, he should have told me, and we could have put him down at the border," Trump said, meaning naming him Secretary of Homeland Security. Trump's Air Force One eruption was the maddest his aides had ever seen him to date. He was so loud that some more junior staffers took a seat in a rear cabin of the plane and put on headphones to drown out the president's yelling. Still, some aides shared their boss's anger. "This is fucked up," said Johnny McEntee, the president's body man. McGahn gave Trump a directive aimed at protecting the president from his own emotions. He could not call Sessions under any circumstances. Otherwise, it could appear as if he were seeking to obstruct justice. When Air Force One touched down at Joint Base Andrews, the president was still so hot that he was urged to sit on board for a while so he could stew in private. Aides explained to him that the press corps would be waiting under the wing, so he shouldn't stop to talk to them, nor should he stalk down the steps of the plane with a scowl on his face. Trump managed to deplane without causing a ruckus, but his fury had not subsided. Rather, it was a rage that boiled into the next day. He went thermonuclear. "The rages, they build and they build," one of his advisors said. "He's screaming, and he's a big guy, and he looks like he could get physical." Trump is famously short-tempered, a trait that predated his presidency. A large physical presence, even when he is sedate, Trump becomes monstrous when something sets him off. "He is scary," said Barbara Rez, a former Trump Organization executive who worked for Trump between the 1970s and the 1990s. She recalled Trump losing his cool during a tour of renovations at the Plaza Hotel shortly after he purchased the Crown Jewel overlooking Central Park in 1988. Inspecting the knockoff furniture purchased for guest rooms, Trump tried to slide back the doors to an armoire, and one of them got caught on a rail. He shook the door, and still it wouldn't move. So he pulled the door off its hinges and threw it to the floor. Then, inspecting one of the bathrooms, he launched into a tirade at Rez over the green Chinese marble. "An Italian verde this was not." "You're no fucking good," Rez recalled Trump yelling at her. "You're making me look bad. This is cheap shit. Who told you to buy this?" Rez had shown Trump three samples of green marble, one for $5, one for $9, and one for $13, and he had picked the cheapest one. "I just stood there and said, 'Donald, you approved it,'" Rez recalled. "I thought he might explode. He was that angry. He was that volatile. His face gets red and his lips get white. He gets in these rages, the screaming, the cursing." The morning of March 3, 2017, Trump was in one of these screaming, volatile rages. In the Oval Office, the president gave Priebus and Bannon an earful about how much he despised Sessions and then summoned McGahn. He wanted to make clear to the White House counsel that he had failed him as well. Trump's words were blistering as he conjured the ghost of Roy Cohn, his former personal lawyer, fixer, and mentor, who had previously been a top aide to Senator Joseph R. McCarthy during the Senate's hunt for communist sympathizers in the 1950s. Trump complained that he wished Cohn were still alive because McGahn wasn't properly protecting him. "I don't have a lawyer," the president screamed. "Where's my lawyer?" McGahn felt Trump's fury was aimed at him, although the president appeared to tilt back and forth in his tirade about his attorney, appearing to be complaining about the abdication of both his White House counsel and his attorney general. Neither was actually Trump's attorney, an important constitutional detail lost on the president. "Roy wouldn't have handled it this way," Trump said, directing his ire at McGahn. "He would have told them all to go to hell." McGahn, Priebus, and Bannon explained to Trump that Sessions had no choice, but Trump wouldn't listen. To him, everything was personal, and he saw Sessions' recusal as a betrayal. The attorney general is the top federal law enforcement official in the country, serving the American people and leading a quasi-independent institution, the Justice Department. In Trump's mind, however, the attorney general's job was to protect the president, and by that measure, Sessions had failed. "Sessions should be fired," he said. "I never would have appointed Sessions if I knew that he would have recused himself," the president said at another point. "Where is my Bobby Kennedy? Where's my Eric Holder? Where's my Roy Cohn?" Trump bellowed to his advisors. Trump held up Holder as a model attorney general because of what he perceived as his unwavering loyalty to Obama and his political savvy. He believed Holder acted as Obama's protector, much the way Robert F. Kennedy had protected his older brother, President John F. Kennedy, as attorney general. Trump cited yet another example, J. Edgar Hoover, the politically cunning FBI director who served under 8 presidents and was later found to have abused his powers. Trump's advisors tried to explain that the attorney general is not the president's personal attorney. Independence was expected at the Justice Department, and the attorney general could not be seen as the president's fixer. Bannon told Trump that times had changed. "There's something that happened between those days of having Bobby Kennedy and J. Edgar Hoover bringing over the files," he said. "It's called Watergate. It just doesn't work like that anymore." Trump believed Sessions should have protected him and his family at all costs. Now, oversight of the probe was transferring to Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, whom Trump hardly knew and therefore did not trust. Trump accused McGahn of not fighting hard enough to defend his oversight of the probe and told him to persuade Sessions to unrecuse himself. That was not legally or ethically possible, and McGahn told him it would look as if the president were interfering with an investigation if anyone at the White House tried to pressure the attorney general. Trump pushed back on McGahn, saying it was a stupid rule. "You're telling me that Bobby and Jack didn't talk about investigations?" Trump said, throwing up his hands in disgust. "Or Obama didn't tell Eric Holder who to investigate?" Once the yelling subsided, Trump gathered a couple of his grandchildren to walk across the South Lawn to board Marine One. They were headed to Mar-a-Lago for the weekend. Bannon and Priebus were planning to accompany the president for the trip to Florida, but they stayed at the White House. "Figure this out," Trump told them. In Trump world, people's fortunes can rise and fall based on the president's changing moods, but the speed with which Sessions went from confidant to persona non grata was breathtaking. Trump and Sessions had known each other for 12 years, first meeting over a shared interest in a New York real estate project. A backbench, ultra-conservative senator from the Gulf Coast of Alabama, Sessions led the crusade in Congress against building a new headquarters for the U.S. mission to the United Nations in New York. He discovered an unexpected ally when he read an article in the New York Sun. The headline, Trump scoffs at UN's plan for new HQ. Sessions invited Trump to testify before a Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Subcommittee on July 21, 2005, and Sessions was spellbound. He told the other senators on the subcommittee, Mr. Trump is a breath of fresh air for this Senate, and praised the star witness for his construction know-how. Sessions then invited Trump to his office to have lunch. Sitting at a conference table in the Russell Senate office building, the two men, one practiced discipline as a Sunday school teacher at his family's Methodist church and kept the Boy Scout motto, Be Prepared, engraved on a stone on his office desk. The other was a bombastic braggart from Queens who broadcast his sexual exploits on Howard Stern's radio show and survived life by winging it, bonded over Subway sandwiches. In Sessions, Trump saw a man who shared his worldview and instincts and could help him establish credibility with conservative base voters. In August 2015, Trump, a newly minted presidential candidate, swooped into Sessions' hometown of Mobile for what was his biggest mega rally to date. It was something between a Lynyrd Skynyrd concert and the Daytona 500. Just before sunset, the sweaty masses in Ladd People's Stadium heard the roar of a jet engine and snapped their heads toward the sky. Gliding toward them was a gleaming Boeing 757 with TRUMP stretched across its navy blue fuselage, dipping its wing toward the sloped stadium bleachers as if to say hello. The flamboyant candidate soon strode on stage to Sweet Home, Alabama, and ticked through all the polls where he was leading Jeb Bush and the other Republican candidates. Sessions was blown away. I've never seen anything like this before, he told one of his political advisors. Something is happening here. After Trump finished speaking that August in Mobile, he invited Sessions and his wife, Mary, into his motorcade of Cadillac Escalades to ride to the airport, where Trump took the couple onto his plane to show it off. The white leather, the gold trim, the big screen TV, everything. In February 2016, Sessions became the first U.S. senator to publicly back Trump and helped craft the candidate's first major foreign policy speech in April 2016. He also lent some of his top staffers to the campaign, including Stephen Miller. Trump bragged about how smart Sessions was. Whenever he saw the senator, he would point at him and say, "So respected," or "Totally gets it." In his mind, there was perhaps no greater attribute than toughness. And Trump would tell aides about Sessions, that guy is tough. Trump had signaled that Sessions could have whatever job he wanted. Initially, Kushner, Bannon, and others in Trump's inner circle favored Rudy Giuliani for attorney general. During the campaign, Giuliani had contorted himself every which way to defend Trump, including after the release of the devastating Access Hollywood tape, in which Trump bragged about sexually assaulting women. They thought the former federal prosecutor and longtime Trump friend was the closest thing to a modern-day Cohn. The trouble is, Giuliani was not interested. I don't have the energy, Giuliani told Bannon one Saturday afternoon in November, talking through a possible cabinet role. You don't understand how tough a job that is, Bannon replied. You've got to do this. We need you. It will only be for a year, but we have to have you. Steve, you're not a lawyer, Giuliani said. You don't understand. It's the worst job. I'm too old. I'm not going to do it. Instead, Trump installed Sessions at the Justice Department with a mandate to oversee a hardline anti-immigration agenda and start rolling back civil rights protections. In a statement, Trump hailed Sessions as a world-class legal mind who is highly respected and greatly admired. For Sessions, becoming Attorney General was a personal triumph. His network of aides and advisors called him Joseph, referring to the Old Testament son of Jacob and Rachel, who was shunned by his brothers and sold into slavery as a boy outcast. But Joseph eventually came under the good graces of an Egyptian pharaoh, rising to become his right hand and oversee the grain supplies of Egypt, ultimately helping civilization survive famine. At Mar-a-Lago the weekend of March 3rd, Trump was joined by his daughter Ivanka and Kushner, who are often described by their admirers as calming influences on the tempestuous president. Ensconced at the Palm Beach Castle, the kids were helpless to contain the president. Trump had a tendency to try to distract from bad news stories by creating new stories. And starting at 6:35 a.m. on March 4th, he pecked out four tweets accusing Obama of orchestrating a politically motivated plot to tap the phones at his Trump Tower campaign headquarters in the run-up to the election. How low has President Obama gone to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? Trump wrote. This is Nixon/Watergate, bad or sick guy. Trump made this explosive allegation without citing any evidence, although a Breitbart article posted the day before about the Obama administration's alleged police state tactics had been circulating among Trump's senior staff. An Obama spokesman, Kevin Lewis, called Trump's allegations simply false. But that didn't seem to bother Trump, who went golfing later that morning and vented to friends. This will be investigated. It will all come out. I will be proven right. Christopher Ruddy said, Trump told him, this is bad. This is really bad. I hope the media focus on this. Just 6 weeks in office, Trump believed he was being tormented in ways known and unknown by a group of Obama-aligned critics, federal bureaucrats, intelligence figures, and, most especially, the news media. His angst over the deep state, already well established, was fomenting daily and fueled by rumors and conspiracies.